Okay, right. Okay. Hi, good morning, everybody. I think I mentioned that I actually have to make a very short trip to the U.S., but I think, Bezras Hashem, this particular class is not going to be affected. So I'm leaving today and hope to come back Tuesday. So I think we're all okay with that. These are maybe we're continuing our discussion of Tanya, but first I do want to correct one fairly serious mistake that I made. I had indicated that the Vilna Gaon had died in the 1770s. That is not true. The Vilna Gaon died in 1797. Now, the reason that's important is the Alter Rebbe's imprisonment was almost immediately after the Petira of the Gra. I had said there were 20 years of separation. That is not true. The Gra, of course, had issued a ban against the Hasidic movements all the way back in 1772. That much is true. But certainly in the Gra's time, they did not try to do things like imprisonment. But right after the Gra died, as is often the case, when the great Gedolim leave the world, the followers like to fool around a little bit. And the Alter Rebbe was imprisoned by the Russian government, by the Tsarist government. The reason was that he was accused. There was a slander against him that he was supporting the Ottoman Turkish governments in Palestine by virtue of his fundraising for the poor of Eretz Israel. And since Russia and Turkey were in a constant state of war, this was regarded as treason. So one has to know that this charge was potentially a capital crime. The Alter Rebbe could have been executed and the like. He was held in prison for 52 days. He was released when even the Tsarist government realized that this was charity collection for the poor. And that was, of course, the famous 19th of Kislev, which became the Rosh Hashanah of Hasidus. And I think I mentioned last week that the Alter Rebbe himself understood this as kind of a debate in Shamayim, whether it was appropriate to teach Kabbalah to the masses. And he said the imprisonment were the Midas Adin arguing that he has no right to reveal these truths, and the ultimate victory implies that it is now a time when this truth needs to be revealed, even to the common man, in anticipation of the coming of Mashiach. Now, there's an alternative version, which almost seems preposterous, in light of the Alter Rebbe's own position, that he was arrested for allegedly giving aid to Napoleon, the French army. Now, that's a very preposterous charge. And of course, that doesn't mean it wasn't made, and it doesn't mean it wasn't part of his prosecution. But as you know, the Alter Rebbe explicitly was against Napoleonic victory, because although Napoleon would have given civil rights to the Jews, the Alter Rebbe felt that the freedom and the emancipation would have created religious challenges, and better to be under the Tsar than to be better to be enslaved under the Tsar than to be free under Napoleon. And of course, a very similar remark in some ways was made by the last Rebbe, Rebbe Nachum Mendel, who said it's easier to be from in Siberia than suburbia, which is perhaps a modern version of that same statement. So it would be very, very paradoxical that the Alter Rebbe would be accused of sending aid to Napoleon. But the point I wanted to make is that the imprisonment was 1 year after less than 1 year after the Petira of the Vilna Gaon. So I made a mistake as to when the Vilna Gaon was nifta. Coming back to the Tanya, and really we're talking about the main part of the Tanya, the largest part of the Tanya, which is Sefer Shel Beinonim, the book of the middle of the roaders. We could even say the book of the mediocre, although halavai v'halvai, that we should be zocha in our lives to reach the Alter Rebbe's definition of what is a Beinoni. It is a very, very difficult book in many, many ways, because it draws heavily on Kabbalah. The vocabulary presupposes a familiarity with all sorts of mystical terms. In fact, in Yeshiva University, Rabbi Norman Lamb, who was the president for many, many years of YU, and now he's president emeritus, technically even Rosh Yeshiva emeritus, but he still teaches. So one of the things he teaches is he gives a share in Tanya, or a class, not a share, I think it's a class in Tanya, for university credit. And his take on it is that if you translate the Tanya into psychological terms, it becomes a very, very accessible work of psychological ethics. Now, I'm not sure if the Alter Rebbe himself would have been so amenable to kind of removing the Kabbalah from the Tanya. Nevertheless, it is very, very true that Kabbalistic concepts themselves find their expression in psychological practice. After all, Kabbalah is essentially deep reality. And superficial reality is a mirror and a reflection of a deeper reality. So essentially, therefore, we can sometimes understand the deep by looking at the superficial, and then we kind of extrapolate. So Rabbi Lam does have a point, but of course that would mean one is watering down the Tanya to a very great extent. Another big problem is that the Alter Rebbe was a complex thinker. Again, that's not for me to personalize it so much. He was very gifted with expression. He expresses himself, again, it's pretentious for me to say it, he expresses himself very well, but he expresses himself in a very, very detailed way. And in fact, one of the characteristics of Chabad Chasidus, as the last Rebbe said, is that they are yored leprate pratim, meaning they are not content with general concepts, but they keep on going deeper and deeper in the detailed specifics. In fact, this is even reflected in the micromanagement of the Rebbe in terms of what every shaliach was doing. But what that means is that the Alter Rebbe is not a brief expositor. The Alter Rebbe, because he goes into such detail, it's sometimes hard to follow. So, for example, in Perek Aleph, the beginning of Tanya, the Alter Rebbe raises four or five questions. And those questions are not really answered till Perek Yud Dalet, the 14th chapter, the 15th chapter, right? We expect, oh, there's a question, give us an answer, Akasha, a Teretz. No, no, no. You need to go through a 15 chapters of exposition till you get the answers. Even the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, said, it's hard to always know how the Alter Rebbe answers a question because he doesn't get to the answer until you've gone through many, many pages. So part of it basically is that although the Alter Rebbe was a very, very gifted Baal Masber, as is seen in the Shulchan Aruch, which is truly a model of clarity in halachic analysis, but because he wants to be so thorough and so detailed, paradoxically, for the common person, that might be a little difficult to follow. We sometimes, in fact, now I see that Chabad has produced a Kitzur Tanya, which I think for 250 years was verboten, totally not allowed. But now they produce a bridge Tanya, so people will get the gist of the idea. Now, even the Kitzur Tanya, what can I tell you? It's still 150 pages, you know. So, how much can you abbreviate? Yeah.
When do children start to learn Tanya?
Well, I see now. You know, there is the Chabad Library on Rehov Yeshayo, and it's also a store. So I was looking there what is available on Tanya. So I see now they have Tanya Laliyaladim. They now have Tanya for children. It all depends. But they start with some introductory ideas of Tanya as early as eight or nine in some cases. But again, the Rebbe wrote a letter in which he said that Tanya should be approached the same way every other part of Torah is approached. And that is, just as when you teach a little child Chumash, you don't get into all of the complications and the commentaries, and you introduce depth with time. So he says Tanya can also be studied in terms of what you might call Pashut Pshat, although again, that's kind of difficult given the fact that the terminology itself is Kabbalistic. So one problem is Kabbalistic terminology. The other problem is that the Alter Rebbe is very lengthy and detailed in his explanations, and therefore we can get lost in the morass. A third problem with Tanya, not a problem, but a third difficulty that a reader might have in Tanya is the Alter Rebbe has so many beautiful throwaway lines. By that I mean, there is a central thesis. Okay? But Derech Agav, incidentally, he'll bring in a Mamar Chazal, he'll bring in a Pasuk, and offer a marvelous, beautiful interpretation of the Pasuk, which is not necessarily totally part of the main thesis, but there are so many digressions, so many interesting pathways and byways that one goes through, and they are literally pinyanim. They're like jewels or rubies or pearls of the Tanya. And, you know, I call them throwaway lines because the Alter Rebbe was not necessarily dealing with it, but he mentions it, Derech Agav. It reminds me of what the Alter Rebbe said about miracles. You know, as remember, that Chabad's Chassidus, the Alter Rebbe said the role of a Rebbe is a spiritual teacher. It's not to do miracles. It's not to give you business advice, unlike other Hasidic Rebbes who were emphasizing miracles. So somebody once asked him, you're a Talmud of the Magid of Mezerich. Were there not miracles when you were with him? And he said, there were so many miracles going on there, we didn't even notice them. He says, the miracles were under the table and we didn't pay attention. He says, there was plenty of miracles, but those were throwaway things. They tell a story once about this. They tell a story, I don't remember who it was about. But Hasidim were once arguing, who has the better Rebbe? So one Chassid said, my Rebbe gave me a bracha that if I invest in a certain business, I'll become a millionaire, and I became a millionaire because I followed the Rebbe's advice. And another person said, I was married for 25 years and didn't have a child, and then I went to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe gave me a bracha, and I had a child. And another person said, I was very, very sick and dying, and the Rebbe gave me a bracha, and I became better. So each one is emphasizing the kayach of the Rebbe's brachas for parnasa, for health, for children, for shidduch. I had a daughter, wasn't married. So another person said, no, my Rebbe is the greatest of all. I asked my Rebbe for business advice, and he told me to do something, and I got bankrupt. And unfortunately, there were no children. I asked for a bracha, and there were no children. And shidduch, I still don't have a shidduch yet, I'm praying. So they look at him like he's crazy, and they say, so what's so great about your Rebbe? He says, my Rebbe is so great that even if all of those things didn't happen, I still go to him. Because his Kedusha, his Torah, his Hadracha is what I look for. I don't look for all of those other things. I pray to Hashem for Yeshua, but the definition of who is my Rebbe does not depend on those things happening. Those are external things. And once again, regardless of how what Chabad eventually became, again, a very, very fascinating issue, the Alter Rebbe's Shita was firmly in that direction. So because of this, Tanya is a difficult sefer to get a handle on for a lot of reasons. But let me try to start with a bit of a structural summary of Sefer Shel Beinonim so that we can begin to look at it. Sefer Shel Beinonim is 53 prakim. Okay, so it's 53 prakim. But one might divide those prakim into seven themes. Now, let me point out that these seven subheadings, which I'm going to give you, are not from the Alter Rebbe. The Alter Rebbe does not subdivide Sefer Shel Beinonim. It's just 53 chapters straight. But one could say that there is a relative structure in terms of dividing it into subheadings. Now, again, this is subjective. One might divide it in different subheadings. Subheading one is Perek Aleph to Ches, right? Chapters 1 to 8. And that deals with the composition and description of the souls that reside within the human body. All of us know that God gave us a soul, but the Alter Rebbe develops the idea, which is not his idea per se, but it's an elaboration of an idea of the Ari, that within the human personality resides two distinct souls, meaning it's not simply Yetzer Hara, Yetzer Tov, but in fact, these are two different souls that are striving for the primacy of man. The guf of a human being is called Ir Kitana, a small city, because it has all these capacities, just like a city can have factories and fields, so we have capacities. But there are rival political factions, right? Labor and Likud, Democrats, Republicans, who are struggling. Who will control the city? There is what is called the Nefesh HaBahamis. There is what is called the animal soul. And the animal soul seeks comfort. It seeks laziness. It seeks inertia. It seeks arrogance. It seeks, in the words of the Alter Rebbe, all of the things that are against Kedusha. That is called the animal soul within the human being. And then there is a godly soul, a soul that is literally a chelek elokami mal. It is, now again, this itself was extremely controversial. It is called part of God. Now, if you remember, one of the more esoteric arguments that the Vilna Gaon has with Hasidus, which some say was actually the strongest argument, is that the Vilna Gaon felt that ascribing divinity to a human soul is tantamount to pantheism, and especially when it was extended to rocks and plants and trees. But nevertheless, the Bala Tanya does take the position that the godly soul within us is a chelek eloka mimal. It is literally godliness per se, and that godliness seeks to connect to God. That is its yearning. That is its desire. And life is a struggle between the godly soul and the animal soul, who will dominate, and the life. Now, why did God make that struggle? Why did God create that animal soul? Because, once again, the concept is, this is already a well-known philosophical idea, the Elder Rebbe was not Mechadesh yet, but that is, goodness is created only when it is the result of a choice that you make because of a struggle. Because if all we were was were naturally good, and we didn't have a countervailing force, then our goodness would be the same goodness as a machine or a computer. Now, indeed, sometimes computers seem to have a life of their own, to be sure, but you understand, if a computer worked well that day, it did not do something good, because goodness connotes volition and choice, and therefore there needs to be this countervailing force. So in Perek Aleph, in part one, which is Aleph Techet, we are given what is called an anatomy of the two souls, what they represent, what they strive for, what is their agenda. Again, there is a concept of knowing thy enemy. Now, to know your strength and know your enemy, and then you will be prepared for the battle, which is the battleground of life. Now, let me point out that even such casual things, you know, Lubavitch has a tradition, actually, of military terminology. I don't know if it's something you ever noticed. The Rebbe constantly referred to his shluchim as Tzivos Hashem, the armies of God, Chayolim, soldiers. In fact, when the Rebbe would send people on shlichus, so I read this interesting thing where parents advised their child, their married son, not to go on that shlichus. They thought it was, well, the Rebbe suggested it, but you know, maybe it's better not to go. There's no frum life there. So the Rebbe wrote a letter. Now, I can imagine for a family to receive a letter of rebuke from the Rebbe, the Chabad family. I don't know. I don't know if they committed suicide or not. I hope everything was okay. But the Rebbe's language was, I thought when someone is my shaliach, they are a soldier in this army. And a soldier doesn't go to his parents to say, is the assignment too dangerous? The Rebbe said, I guess I was wrong. Again, my mom is the prophet, says, I guess I was wrong. I guess your son was not a soldier in the army. But there is this concept of military terminology, Tzivos Hashem. And that really emanates from the notion that the dominant image that the Tanya portrays is that of war. War. Not war against the external enemy. But we have the Ir Katana, that's me, the small city. And there are two armies that are fighting for control of that city. The Nefesh HaBahamit and the Nefesh HaLokit. Who's going to win? Now, in Perek Aleph Techet, he's not giving you strategies. He's just describing it, meaning the strategies of victory are later. I'll get to that. But Perek Aleph Techet, or part one, is simply the anatomy of the struggle. Who is the enemy? And who is the one that should have the victory? And that describes the different souls. Now, in the anatomy of the soul, the Alter Rebbe introduces actually a fundamental idea, which is why Chabad is called Chabad. Chabad. Chachma. Chabad is an abbreviation. By the way, I don't want to get into the later history of Chabad too much. I just want to tell you that for most of the 19th century, Chabad Hasidus and Lubavitch Hasidus were not identical. There were actually non-Lubavitch Chabad offshoots by Brisk. So what I mean by this is the following. The Alter Rebbe, who never lived in Lubavitch, the Alter Rebbe was, of course, the founder of Chabad. Right, there's no question about that. All Chabad is connected to the Alter Rebbe. But after the Alter Rebbe died, there were various succession crises. Many Hasidim, most perhaps, went to his son, Rav Dov Ber, the Mittler Rebbe, called the Middle Rebbe. Others went to a great disciple, Rav Shneur Zalman's closest disciple, who was Rav Aaron of Staroshelya, meaning he was not a biological successor. Now then you had the third Rebbe, the Tzemach Tzedek. Now the Tzemach Tzedek was a Hasidish Rebbe for many, many years, and he had many, many children. His youngest son, Shmuel, became the fourth Rebbe of Lubavitch, but his other sons founded other Chabad groups. So you have to know that Lubavitch, for quite a while, was an offshoot. It was one of the offshoots of Chabad, but there were other Chabad Rebbeim. And that actually continued until, really, the 1950s, until Rav Yosef Yitzchak came to America. One of the things he did was he consolidated all Chabad groups under Lubavitch. And I mean, if you look at the history, you will see that when Rav Yosef Yitzchak came to the United States, he was not the Rebbe of all Chabad Hasidim. He was the Rebbe of Lubavitch Hasidim. And there were other Chabad groups that didn't consider him to be their leader at all, but for whatever reason, he managed to consolidate. So one has to know, Lubavitch and Chabad are not exactly the same, although today, basically Lubavitch and Chabad are synonymous. Okay, be it as it may, why is it called Chabad? So the Alter Rebbe introduces in part one of the Tanya this idea that in the Nefesh, which comes from God, the Nefesh Elokit, there are 10 kochot, there are 10 powers that God put into the godly soul, which parallel the 10 sphirot, the 10 emanations that come from God. That in a sense, the godly soul is a mirror of the kochot within the Godhead, within the Ein Sof. And these are called the kochos ha-nefesh. And when you look at the 10 spheros, they are divided into two groups. The first three spherot are called seichel. They are God's intellectual attributes. They are chachma, bina, and das. Now, some count them keser, chachma, bina, but the Rebbe is going with chachma, bina, das. Now, I'll go back and explain it a little bit. The second group, the lower seven, are called midot. Seichel and midot. And these midot include chesed, loving kindness, gevura, strength, tiferes, beauty, netzach, eternity, hod, also a type of glory, yesod, foundation, and malchus. Seichel and midot. And the concept is that we're trying to analogize that the way God brings his presence into the world parallels in some way human thought. Chachma is the initial thought. Let's say, for example, you're an architect or you're a designer, let's say, and you wanted to build a chair. Or you want to build a building, you're an architect. So Chachma is the initial flash, I want a building, that initial idea. Bina is to be marchiv, when you take the initial idea of a building, and then you plan out in your mind the details, the rooms, the size, the dimension. That is why chachma parallels the male that deposits the zera, the little seed, and bina is feminine that takes that seed and develops it into a child. So chachma is the initial creative impulse, which actually comes out of nowhere. It just comes. You wake up and say, I want to do a building. Bina is to take that idea and elaborate. That's why, as I say, chachma and bina are described as Abba and Ima, father and mother. Dat, just as, again, we're describing Hashem right now, Kav Yochel, we're describing HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Das is when Chachma and Bina work together in tandem, just like when Adam and Chava come together. That is called Vayeda, right? Adam knows Chava. Das is the connection of Chachma and Bina. So Abba and Ima come together and they produce little children. And the little children that Chachma and Bina produce are the various midot, the various manifestations of God in the world. Kindness, din, and the like. So the Alter Rebbe says the following. Again, I realize this is very, very abstract, and obviously I myself do not understand this in an extremely deep way. But as I say, if Tanya can be taught to 8-year-olds, we could try a little bit ourselves. And the concept is that the way Hashem interacts with the world is the Seichel, the Chachma, Bina, and Das, gives birth to the Midos. Because they are the children. The Arizal uses a sexual imagery. Chachma is father. Bina is mother. Das is union. Midot are the toladot, the offspring of the unification of Chachma and Das. So here, what the Alter Rebbe says is the following. If the Nefesh Elokis is literally part of God, part of God's essence, and the kochot, the powers that God puts in the Nefesh Elokis, are those powers of the 10 spheros, the 10 kochot ha-nefesh, then the same way that God's midot emanate from the Seichel, they are the children of Chachma and Bina, so too, our midot, our emotions, our feelings of compassion, our love, our need to be strict sometimes, must emanate from the Seichel of Chachma, Bina, Vidas. And he points out, there are different types of emotions. Superficial emotions that don't emanate from intellectual contemplation are the province of the Nefesh HaBahamit. They are simply the animal feelings. And he points out that even the animal feelings might be positive. So for example, if I get excited by dancing or whatever it is, that could be a feeling of closeness to God, but that's coming from the animal soul. And the animal soul can also get some pleasure in spiritual activities. But in true godliness, emotions and feelings must emanate from the Seichel, because that's how God operates. Hence, the Alter Rebbe called his Chassidus Chabad, that our feelings of Dveikus in Hashem come from thought and meditation and study and learning. Now, the concept is not to disparage emotions, but rather to recognize that genuine, deep emotion comes from thought and contemplation, as opposed to other types of chassidus that went by the name Chagat. Chagat is Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet, which are the midos. The other movement started from the emotions, and the Alter Rebbe taught one must start from the mind. Now, as I expressed it, this is based on a very heavy Kabbalistic terminology that the Kochot HaNefesh parallel the 10 Sphiros, and the 10 Sphiros are Seichel Umidos, and in Kabbalistic terminology, it is the Chachma Bina unified in Das that produces Chesed Gevura, and therefore our Nefesh has to parallel that, right? That's the Kabbalistic vocabulary that the Alter Rebbe uses. But, to follow Rabbi Lamb's way here, you can understand, I hope, the psychological meaning of this. And that is the Alter Rebbe, realistically, because he was a realist, amazingly enough, with all of the theoretical structures that he mastered and that he articulated, he was actually very, very down to earth. And he had a very deep suspicion of people whose connection to Judaism comes from emotionality. Because emotions come and go. Emotions are ephemeral. There are times you're going to be filled with love and times you're going to be filled with sadness. We are kind of like everybody to some degree, even if you don't have a clinical diagnosis. We are bipolar in one way or the other, at least in a modest way. And therefore he felt emotionality, if there is such a word, is a recipe for turbulence, for inconsistency, for a lack of rootedness and stability. But when it's rooted in thought and in contemplation, it then becomes real and permanent. And once again, the Kabbalistic structure is that the Nefesh Elokit has the 10 kochot of the 10 sfirot, and just as in Hashem's creative process, it is Chachma and Bina, which are unified in Da'at, that produces the Midot, so too in the Nefesh Elokit, it must follow the same strategy. So already in the first part of the Tanya, the concept of Chabad is introduced. Now, I don't want to talk about autobiographical influences on the Bala Tanya, but I will speculate that part of what led Rav Schneur Zalman to this conclusion was the fact that one of his great Hasidic colleagues, Rav Avram Kalisker of Kalisk, was a person who basically taught, he was also a Talmud of the Mezritch Ramagin. And he had been a Talmud of the Vilna Gaon, strangely enough. But he had left the Vilna Gaon. Rav Ram of Kalisk believed in kind of almost an extreme expression of emotionalism. Some of his followers did somersaults during davening. Some of them got drunk, got intoxicated, were involved in 24-hour partying. I mean, that put the worst face on, in fact, the Maggid. The Maggid himself, who was very, very ill, wanted to take the matters in his own hands and rebuke Rav Avram, who was dissuaded from doing so, whatever it is. So I don't think it's unreasonable that Rav Schneur Zalman's words might be directed not so much against the Misnagdim, but might be directed against Rav Avram of Kalisk, who very much emphasized a high emotional fervor. Divorce. In fact, Rav Ram of Kalisk was against the Tanya as a sefer. He said, too much Kabbalah. Forget about Kabbalah. Let's just, you know, dance and pray, praise Hashem. But the Alter Rebbe very much felt not that way. So that is kind of, part one of the Tanya. And here he also introduces a phraseology that he uses quite a lot. And he says, kochot ha-nefesh, which are purely spiritual entities, cannot really be expressed in a physical way. This pure spirituality is really an indescribable force until it is put in a lavush. Just like, imagine a person, you're an invisible man, like you see, I'm sure you've seen these old movies where the person is invisible, but when he puts on a garment, we can see him, we can see the garment. It's like a suit just walking. So he says, kochot ha-nefesh have no vehicle of expression except through the levush that they wear. Meaning, this is a very common phrase, the kochot are mitlabesh in three levushin, and the three levushin are machshava, dibor, and masa. Thought, deed, action. Now this itself is very, very interesting, because without the Alter Rebbe, I might have thought, well, the thought is my neshama. And then I have speech and action that takes my thoughts and brings them out. He's actually saying, no, thought is just another type of externality, although it's not revealed to other people, of some deeper spiritual essence. Meaning to say, again, there's much profundity here. Meaning to say that A person is deeper than their thoughts. Fascinating. Is this anticipating the subconscious? Meaning there's an innermost essence of a godly soul that not only transcends your deeds and your speech, but it even transcends your thoughts. Now, the reason why that's important is this is setting the stage for the concept of the pintaliyid. And that is, let's say you have a Jew who behaves in an evil way. So of course he's doing averos. His actions are no good. His speech is no good. But the Alter Rebbe is teaching, you know, even if his thoughts, even if in his mind and his thoughts, he hates Hashem, hates the Torah, hates the Jewish people, and wants nothing to do, that's not the real him. You see, we might have said superficially, okay, I understand, your actions don't always reflect who you are. But your thoughts reflect who you are. Alter Rebbe says, no, this is why vocabulary is very significant. The Alter Rebbe describes machshava. Machshava is not the same as nefesh elokis, or nefesh ba'amitz for that matter. The machshava is a lavush. So even if your lavush is not good, you're wearing a dirty suit or a ripped up dress, that doesn't reflect the purity of the essence inside. Right, so the notion of pintaliyit, no matter how bad a person is, there is goodness inside, comes from this idea. So that's why the use of the term levushim of the nefesh are very, very significant, because by calling something a levush, you are saying it's an externality, and even thought is an externality, because it's a levush. Now he does point out that thought is a more spiritual levush than speech and action, because it's intangible. And that's why, again, in one of the throwaway lines of the Alter Rebbe, so to speak, he makes the point that a sin in thought might be even worse than a sin in action, because it penetrates to a level that is closer to the soul, although it's not at the soul itself. Interesting point. We might have thought the action is worse than the thought. He said the thought might be worse than the action, but it's still a levush. The mashal that he gives is that machshava is like a precious, expensive garment. Dibor and maaseh are cheaper outer garments, and a pagam in a more expensive garment is more distressing than a pagam in a less expensive garment and the like. Okay, so this is really just part one. This is Perek Aleph to Ches, and again, whatever you call it, you can call it what you want, but I would just describe it as the anatomy of the two souls. And basically you could say, knowing the two sides in the battle over you. Right? Knowing your enemy, knowing your friend, and you just identify and describe. Now part two, which is, again, Perek Tes to Yud Zayin. And again, these are arbitrary. Again, I will admit these are arbitrary, but these have been helpful to me, so it might be a convenient way of getting a handle on the map. Now describes the idea of struggle and conflict, meaning after we've described our enemies, we then describe the idea of the struggle, the idea of the conflict. And here, what is very, very important is this is where the Alter Rebbe introduces the definition of Beinoni, which is so unusual. Again, to remind people, the term Tzadik Rasha Beinoni is a term that appears in the Gemara several times. It's not, the Alter Rebbe did not make up these terms. The Gemara talks about it, the Rambam talks about it, and the like. In fact, I once saw, although I don't think there's a source for this, a late, the Torah Tamima writes in one of his Svarim, that the word Sibor, congregation, could be seen as an abbreviation. Tzadikim, Beinonim, Urishaim, right? Sadek, Beis, Vav, Resh. That's a Tzibor. What's a Tzibor? Tzibor has all types. The Tzadikim, the Beinonim, and even the Rishayim have to be part of our Tzibor. Remember the Gemara says that in the Ketores, one of the ingredients in the Ketores was Chelbana, that was Recha Ra'a, to show that at least when there's a public tainus, you have to be Mishtatef, even the Posha'ei Yisrael, and that's the lesson of Lulav and Esrog as well, right? The Arava, the willow represents the people without mitzvahs, without Masim Tovim. So the concept of Tzadik Rasha Beinoni is a well-known idea. But how do we define Tzadik Rasha Beinoni? So let me remind you. According to Rambam, Tzadik is any person who is more righteous than evil, meaning he has more mitzvot than averot. If you're 51% good, you're a tzaddik. If you're 60% good, you're more of a tzaddik. If you're 70% good, you're even a bigger tzaddik. But you hit tzaddik at 51%. Now, even the Rambam says that that's not a pure numerical calculation. Hashem has a handicapping that we're not aware of, meaning to say, the Rambam writes that a certain mitzvah might have involved so much mesirat nefesh that it counts like a million. So if you have, again, an example I think of, I'll give you an example that I think of when I think of this Rambam. Now, many, many years ago, I was involved, I guess I could say, I can't say this in North America, but I'll say it here. I was involved in NCSY. I worked with NCSY. And most of the NCSY kids are from public school. And some of them are in the process of becoming religious, but some of them have become religious. And I remember a girl got up. So Motze Shabbos was like a kumzitz where people would get up and tell their personal stories. So I remember a story that a girl was saying. She was in high school. And she actually said that her parents do not let her keep Shabbos. They don't let her. She goes into the bathroom. She lights Shabbos candles when her parents aren't aware. She makes a bracha. And then she has to blow them out and turn on the fan. Now, you could give a smicha test as to how many averos she transgressed. I mean, from making a bracha in the bathroom, to lighting probably after dark, to blowing the candles out, to turning on the fan. Avera after avera. And you can look at that and say, you know, she missed the boat. But I can't speak for HaKadosh Baruch. But Hashem looks not only at the external act, Hashem looks at the devotion, at the Mesiras Nefesh, how much she wanted to keep Shabbos and do what she could do. And it might be, based on the Rambam, that perhaps her action of trying to honor the Shabbos might count more, as wrong as it was in so many ways, might count more than the standard 100% good Shabbos that we keep here in Yerushalayim. We don't know. So even the Rambam admits that there's a certain handicapping. There might be a mitzvah that equals a million mitzvahs. And therefore, even if you have a lot of averos, this mitzvah could override it. Or vice versa, maybe you have a lot of mitzvahs that were done superficially, and then one biggie avera that counts like a million. So the Rambam says it's not purely numerical, but however Hashem weighs and counts them, it is 51% you're 51% good, you're a tzaddik, 51% evil, you're a Rasha. Now, the big problem with the Rambam's definition is that if you're looking at it in that way, then l'chora, that's not really a meaningful category in some ways, because that could change from 10 o'clock to 10:01. I mean, let's imagine that at 10 o'clock, you know, I happen to have 51% mitzvos and 49% averos, based on whatever weighing Hashem uses. At 10:01, I yell at my wife. So I was at tzaddik. Then I became, of course, yelling at your wife counts for a million. So by definition, you become a Rasha. I mean, that changes minute by minute by minute by minute. It's like you're in an intensive care unit, and you have to kind of monitor, you know, heartbeat and pulse and everything else. And then the Alter Rebbe asks other kashas in the sugya of Beinoni. So Rabbah said, I am only a Beinoni. And the question is, I mean, Is Rabbah delusional? Rabbah was certainly a righteous person who did many more, much more good than evil. Why would Rabbah say he's a Beinoni? Is that false modesty? So because of this, the Alter Rebbe introduces a striking, radical idea that is certainly not the Pashut Pshat of the Gemara, but he says a Beinoni is actually a person who doesn't sin at all. He totally serves Hashem with all of the levushim, the garments of his soul. He serves Hashem with machshava. He doesn't even sin in his thoughts. Machshava, dibor, maaseh. So, if that's what a beinoni is, what's a tzaddik? I mean, how do you get better than that? So he basically says the following idea. He says, a tzaddik is a person who has vanquished and perhaps destroyed the animal soul entirely. And the Alter Rebbe says, that is not a madrega that every person could attain, even with our free will. It is not a madrega Hashem expects us to attain. You're either born that way, or Hashem gives it to you as a gift in the merits of your devotion. And he does say, one should aspire to be a tzaddik, and maybe perhaps in the merit of your devotion, God will make you a tzaddik, but that's nothing you can do. You can't do anything about that. Meaning to say, as righteous as you are, you will still have that animal soul trying to pull you down, and you got to struggle with it. But he says, the Beinoni does have this animal soul, and the Beinoni does have this negative force trying to pull it down, but the Beinoni subjugates and doesn't give in. And the Beinoni does not allow the Levushin to be claimed by the animal soul. And they only remain with the godly soul. He says that is called Beinoni, not because that's an average. Is that the average person? No, it's not. But it's called Beinoni because every single person is capable of being a Beinoni. So it may sound bad in translation, right? God expects every person to be mediocre. But that's not what a Beinoni means. A Beinoni simply means a person who lives in the world of struggle. You're in the war. The tzaddik is not in the war anymore. Either he never was in the war, which might be a rare situation, or he's won the war. A Beinoni means you're in the war. But being in the war doesn't mean you have to lose. You can win. And a Beinoni is a person who successfully wins that war and the like. Now, let me explain again, psychologically, again, I actually have not seen Norman Lamb's shiur, but I understand what he's saying, that, in fact, the Rebbe himself, although the Rebbe didn't speak in those terms, the Rebbe didn't say, learn Tanya like a psychology book, but the Rebbe did say that one does not learn Tanya properly unless you ask yourself practically, how does this impact on my life? So it can't just be theoretical. So practically, so we translate it into terms that apply to us, you know, in everyday life. Simple everyday life. Remember that Tanya was written as a counseling manual for the Hasidim, who the Rebbe was no longer able to see them personally, and they had questions. And their questions basically are, why do I struggle so much? Shouldn't I reach a place where I no longer have these urges, I no longer have this Yetzer Hara? And they saw this as a failure. They saw this as a weakness. They saw this as a source of despair. So the Alter Rebbe is saying, no, that's what life is. That's what a Beinoni is. A Beinoni lives the life of struggle. The Tzaddik has gone beyond it. Of course, the big question is, what is the mission of a tzaddik? Why do tzaddikim stay alive? Right? Well, I'll talk about that briefly as well. But that's not the subject of this book. And the Alter Rebbe says, the fact that you still have things that are pulling you down just means there's an active nefesh habahamis that's still here. But the beinoni can be minatzeach over them. So you see how practical this is, meaning we don't look at struggle as a sign of failure. We just look at it as a sign of vigilance and the need to, you know, take charge. Allow the godly soul to win. So this is what the second part is addressing, the idea of the struggle and conflict between the soul. And the Alter Rebbe uses an analogy from wrestling, of all matters. He says that if two people are wrestling, like Yaakov and the angel, so even if one is stronger than the other, but if the stronger person is lazy, not putting his best effort, he will be defeated by the weaker. So too in the spiritual struggle of the Beinoni. If you're lazy, if you're depressed, if you don't put forth your best effort, the other side is going to win. Right? Again, military analogies, wrestling analogies. Got to look at it like a fight. Life is a fight. It's like a battle out there. It's a war. Right? We're familiar, unfortunately, in Eretz Yisrael with the wars in the streets. But there's also a war inside of us. And that's actually the more important one. The Chayvos HaLevavos, much, much earlier than the Alter Rebbe, Chayvos HaLevavos was written almost 1,000 years before the Tanya, maybe 800 years before the Tanya, gives a mashal that a very successful general came back from a military campaign. And there was a triumphal parade like they made for MacArthur, you know, after World War II. And people were praising the general for the great military victory. And the Chacham went over to the general and said, "You have thankfully finished a little war, but now you must fight the big war. The big war is against the arrogance and conceit within yourself. That is a much more difficult war." Some say, at the time when we used to have a space program, I used to explore outer space. So what is that called in Hebrew? The chalal. I think chalal chitzoni literally means outer space. So somebody said, the reason we are so interested in the chalal chitzoni is because we are afraid to look at the chalal panimi. We are afraid to look at the inner emptiness. So we look at the outer emptiness. Okay, so that's really, so part one is the anatomy of the soul. Part two is the nature of struggle and conflict, and the very, very important idea of the mission of the Beinoni. The Beinoni lives with struggle, but the Beinoni is expected by Hashem through free will, not only to control his actions and his speech, but even to control his thoughts. Now, he'll talk about, we're still not talking practical yet. Practical will be later. We're just setting up the mission. And his emotions, which, as we described, are supposed to come from the thoughts, rather than vice versa. Okay, this is the Alter Rebbe's message to his Hasidim. And we should feel that it's the Alter Rebbe's message to us. Chabad always says, when you learn Tanya, you should feel that you have a yechidus with the Alter Rebbe, because the Tanya was a substitute for that yechidus that the Alter Rebbe was not able to provide at the time, and certainly is not able to provide right now, since he's not physically in this world. Okay, so this introduces the idea of Beinoni, and everybody can be a Beinoni. That's the point that we need to know. So the truth of the matter is, again, what this does mean, in effect, this is the downside of it, is that most of us, most of the time, are technically Rishayim who aspire to be Beinonim. Meaning Beinoni is our goal in life. But you're not a Beinoni, you see, until you're able to control the Levushei HaNeshama, Machshava, Dibor, Maaseh. And indeed, the Alter Rebbe brings a Gemara that says, if a person does even one Aveira, he is a rasha until they do tshuva. Because he says, because we have failed in our mission in that particular time. So that may sound a little depressing, but at the same time, remember that each of us can and must become Beinoni. So our mission is to become a Beinoni. That depends on us. Whether we become tzaddik, that is a gift from God. That does not depend on us per se. That is a matana. And therefore, as it says, according to the Alter Rebbe, tzaddikim are born and not made. Beinonim are made. We make ourselves the Beinoni. Tzaddik is something that Hashem gives us. Okay. Now, part three, and I'll just begin this, is Parakim 18, Yitzches, to Chafei. And here, he does, the Alter Rebbe again goes back, reiterates, and elaborates the very powerful idea that because the Nefesh Elokis is actually part of God, there is in the Nefesh Elokis a natural, uncontrollable yearning and love for God. You don't have to learn to love God. You don't have to learn to revere God. It is imprinted in our deepest essence. We just have to find a way to uncover it, to discover it. It is deeper than our thoughts, once again, because since the thought is only a levush of the neshama, it is not the neshama, then even if on a conscious level we don't feel anything for Hashem, chas v'shalom, that love is still there. And there will be dramatic occasions when that love will come out, such as Mesiras Nefesh, right, such as the Jew that is forced to convert to Christianity, etc., and will give up his life even though he was totally not religious. The source of Mesiras Nefesh, that so many Jews, even Rishonim, are willing to give their life for God, is because there are going to be moments in which that love for God kind of escapes the neshama and emerges into consciousness. And therefore, this is the idea, this is called Ava Misuteris, the hidden, concealed love that is imprinted into the neshama Elokis. Now, let me just say this, that Rav Kook was not a Chabad, but Rav Kook had a great affinity for Chabad Chassidus. Actually, his maternal grandfather was a Chabad Chassid. And they say Rav Kook used to always carry around a Tanya with him. It was one of the Sfarim that he had with him. Sfas Emes he also loved, so Rav Kook was eclectic, as everybody knows. But it's interesting that Rav Kook used this idea in his understanding of secular Zionism. I'm not referring to Mizrahim, I'm talking about secular Zionism, Theodore Herzl, you know, the whole secular Zionist, that in fact not only were not religious personally, but many, not all, I don't mean to make any generalizations, but there were many Zionist founding fathers and some mothers who really, really, really were very, very anti the Torah. They didn't believe in God. They believed that religion was a galut mentality that belonged to the diaspora. They wanted to create a new, powerful Jew who no longer needed the old ways. And these were the people who would, you know, eat on Yom Kippur, and they would have events, you know, sporting events on Shabbat. And as you know, most of the old Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael looked at them as heretical and keep away from them and bad people, etc. And as we know, Rav Kook befriended them, and Rav Kook treated them with respect and with love. And Rav Kook was pilloried. Rav Kook was greatly, greatly, greatly criticized for this. But mystically, it wasn't just a question that he was trying to be makar of them. That was part of it. He wanted to bring them to Torah. But Rav Kook had a mystical idea that those who come to build up the land of Israel, it is their godly soul that is pushing them to do it. That their godly soul feels the presence of God and wants to connect. But that godly soul, the message is garbled by the animal soul. So it turns into politics, it turns into atheism, it turns into socialism. But the actual activity is an expression of the hidden love that is actually within the recesses of even the apostate, non-believing, hostile Jew. Now, Rav Kook says this a number of places, and once again, you know, who knows, but this is the idea of the hidden love that the Baal HaTanya talks about so much. The idea that even if consciously I seem to be acting for other motives. So the levush, the garment of my soul, was captured by the animal soul. That does not affect the essence of the godly soul. And therefore Rav Kook took the position that some people come to Eretz Yisrael because of their relationship with Hashem, and some people come to Hashem through their relationship with Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Kook did believe that eventually, if not the secularists themselves, but their children or their grandchildren, would eventually come back to Hashem, not in spite of what their grandparents did, but because of what their grandparents did. You can understand why this was a very controversial idea. It still is among the very religious people, whether Haredim or whatever you want, whatever label you want to use. But this was Rav Kook's idea. Rav Kook saw, even in the actions that are externally against the Torah, he saw in them roots of holiness emanating from the godly soul. So this is largely based, at least as a source, it is based on this. And of course, I do want to say, Rav Kook did go further than the Tanya, because there is a chapter, Perek Ches of the Tanya says, actually says, that sinful acts cannot be elevated to God even when they're done with good motives. So it seems that the Baal HaTanya is saying that we don't accept the idea that sinful acts can be expressions of holiness. Okay, well, again, you know, one could write a sefer on this or a doctoral dissertation. So I don't mean to say Rav Kook is following the Tanya lock, stock, and barrel. But the idea that there is a hidden love in the soul of every Jew, Rav Kook certainly took that idea and built on it and expanded it and the like. In fact, it's interesting. There's a very fascinating book some of you may have come across. It was written like 30, 40 years ago by a Reform rabbi, Herbert Weiner, who died, I think, a few years ago. The book is called Nine and a Half Mystics. He's a half mystic. And it talks about his meetings. He was interested in Kabbalah, and he met with Adam Steinsaltz when Steinsaltz was like 20 years old, and he met with Lubavitcher Rebbe when the Rebbe just became Rebbe in 1950, whatever it was, in the early 50s, and the like. So, and he met with Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook and Rav David Cohen, the Nazir. He really met with every Breslov people. He met with all sorts of people. So at one point, he has Yechidus with the Rebbe, and so Weiner says to the Rebbe, "Oh, what you're saying sounds like Rav Kook." Then he notices that the Rebbe didn't say anything. So Weiner asks the Rebbe, he says, "The Rebbe doesn't like Rav Kook?" So the Rebbe just says, very calmly, he says, "Rav Kook was trying to incorporate too many things. When you incorporate too many things, things get confusing. It's easier to have one, you know, one consistent path." So Chabad did disassociate from Rav Kook, but still, there's no question about it that a lot of Rav Kook's ideas come from Chabad in one way or the other, but indeed, as a creative gadol in his own right, he took it in different directions. Okay, we'll see you, Mitzvah Shem. I hope to be here next week. If there shouldn't be a problem, if there is a problem, I will tell you as soon as I become aware that there's a problem. Okay. So there is an outside chance I won't be here next week, but I plan on being here.